Thank you. Thank you very much to Sana and the other organizers and Ali for that kind introduction. And thank you all for being here. I will hopefully this will be useful when we get to chat a little bit. So I'll spend the minimum time necessary to set out the stage, and then it'll be good to have a sense of how people see these issues, and I can respond to that. In 2011, the British journalist Declan Walsh wrote a report in The Guardian entitled Pakistan's Secret Dirty War, the first in a series of fairly controversial exposés that eventually led to him being expelled from the country. In later reports, Walsh discussed the intrigues in the so-called war on terror against Islamists in the Pashtun-majority northern regions, which at that time ostensibly were the main reason that the authorities threw him out. But my sense is that it was his first article about Balochistan, about the secret dirty war in Balochistan, which really set the cat amongst the pigeons. You know, a number of Western journalists have written a number of damning books and newspaper reports about the dubious manner in which the Pakistani military is prosecuting the so-called war on terror against Islamists. So that's not really news in some ways, but the Balochistan story has indeed remained largely a secret and continues to be today. There was, however, a brief lull between 2011 and maybe 2014, when at least some of the realities of what's gone on in Balochistan became public, due largely to what started off as a fairly modest organizational effort by the relatives of Baloch youth and political activists that had been disappeared since 2005, when the most recent insurgency in Balochistan began, and which, for the record, is the fifth of its kind since 1948. The issue of what became known as missing persons occupied the media and political spotlight for a while, and in part because some of you will know that there was this very populist Chief Justice, Iftikhar Chaudhry, who took it up in the Supreme Court, and you know that played out over a number of many months, and so therefore missing persons, Balochistan, and everything to do with it sort of was being talked about for a bit. And that culminated, I think, in early 2014, some 2 years ago, in what was called the Long March of the relatives of these missing persons from Quetta to Islamabad. So they marched on foot about 3,000, you know, about, what is it, 1,500 kilometers through the country, and that sort of again generated spotlight for some time. Essentially, whether or not anyone in Pakistani officialdom and the military in particular was held to account for what was going on in Balochistan, you know, for a while the veil of secrecy over the dirty war was lifted. It became fairly common knowledge. In fact, in the Supreme Court hearings, there was a number of times where the IG, the Inspector General of the Frontier Constabulary, was called to court and asked to answer by the Supreme Court Chief Justice, asked to answer for very clear evidence that the uniformed personnel of the state were picking up people and disappearing them. That nothing came of those hearings. Nobody was eventually held to account as such beyond those sort of sporadic accusations is another matter, but it became common knowledge that there was these kill and dump operations targeting Baloch nationalists going on, and importantly the rest of the country, which is an important point here, because there is, especially in Punjab, which is the dominant province, there's very little sense of anything about Balochistan. It's almost like another country. There's very little awareness. You could ask someone in Punjab the name of five cities in Balochistan, they wouldn't be able to come up with it. You could ask someone in Punjab Or if you ask someone in Punjab, who are the people who occupy or live in Balochistan, they'll call them their Balochis, which is actually not right. Balochi is the language, and the right term is to say they're Baloch. So, you know, there's that level of misinformation and a lack of awareness in the rest of the country. So what happened in this brief period is at least the rest of the country was forced to sit up and take notice about something actually going on. Over the past year or so, however, the matter has again essentially receded almost entirely from the public eye. And the breaking point, arguably, was the murder of an activist last April, in fact, on April 25th, Sabine Mahmood in Karachi. A few hours, and this was, of course, literally a few hours after she had invited the missing persons group to come and talk about their struggle. That lecture ended, that event ended, she closed up her, she had this space called T2F in Karachi. She closed up T2F, she locked up, she got in the car, and she was driving home and she was shot dead. While the official investigation into the murder concluded that it had nothing to do with her support of these Baloch activists, and the eerie silence on all matters Balochistan that has persisted since suggests that maybe, as is the case with official investigations in Pakistan, that maybe they're not letting us know exactly what was going on. So now it's been in the same period, this last 12 to 14 months, that another set of developments, without an obvious connection to the Baloch nationalist insurgency, has unfolded, which I will suggest has further tilted the balance of power between the Pakistani security apparatus and Baloch insurgents in favor of the former. And that I refer in particular to the announcements and subsequent operationalizing of the famed China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, or what is now the CPEC, is something that is on everybody's tongue, as Ali was pointing out earlier. It's generally celebrated as a game changer in Pakistan. Essentially, what it is a series of road and related infrastructure projects that will bring in almost $50 billion of Chinese investment, and that the purpose of which is to link up the China border on the northernmost tip of the country to the still under construction deep sea port of Gwadar on the southwesternmost tip of the country, and not just the country of Balochistan in particular. So there's been some controversy about CPEC within the mainstream, but it's limited only to the route of this corridor, where this road should be built. So outside of Punjab, within sort of Pashtun, Sindhi sort of mainstream society or mainstream politics, less Sindhi, because it doesn't affect Sindh at all, in fact, mostly Pashtun nationalists have argued that the route should, what is called the Western route, i.e., it should pass mostly through Pashtun areas and to some extent Baloch, as opposed to a route that's further to the east, which will pass mostly through Punjab. So that's been the extent of the controversy. There's almost no voice in the political mainstream about the deeper geopolitical significance of China's intervention. And particularly the extent to which Chinese patronage empowers the Pakistani military to strengthen its own power on just about everything. Everything from its policy on Balochistan to the polity at large to how economic development should proceed. And that is not being talked about. I mean, there's in hushed tones it's discussed. Renegades like ourselves might talk about it, but it's absent from the mainstream almost entirely. And those of you who follow Pakistan know that today in Pakistan, you know, there's a king who rules Pakistan today, and his name is Raheel Sharif. He's like a king. You know, the way his images are plastered up all over the country, the way he's depicted as the savior, it's quite pervasive, both within the media and otherwise. You know, obviously, Pakistan is a country in which the military has always exercised that kind of role. You know, obviously, Pakistan is a country in which the military has always exercised that kind of role. But the manner in which the military's power has, or the military's image in particular, has sort of just has re-emerged in a big way in recent times, I think is not by chance. I think it has a lot to do with, particularly with CPEC in China. So it's one of the ironies of I think, Western government's policy towards Pakistan and the Afghanistan-Pakistan region at large since 2001, since the onset of the so-called war on terror, that the military has not only maintained, and I would argue to some extent, expanded its role as arbiter in the polity. And I say it's ironic because, as I started off with, this is the same, not Western governments, to an extent Western governments, but within, you know, whether the Western Academy or Western sort of the journalistic community, there's innumerable accounts of the double game that the Pakistani military plays. I mean, you go into a bookstore and every second book will be about the Pakistani military and the Taliban and this shady game that they all play, you know. So it's a bit odd that on the one hand this is a well-acknowledged fact, but on the other hand, you know, explicit policy, you know, Western government's policies towards Pakistan have actually strengthened the military in all sorts of ways, whether literally in terms of aid, infrastructure, military support, or as I'm suggesting, in terms of its political sort of influence more generally. And the part of this is, of course, because whether in Pakistan or elsewhere, the coercive apparatus of the state everywhere has been greatly expanded in the name of fighting terror. And Pakistan is not an exception to that general rule. In Pakistan's case, it may stand out in certain ways, but as you know, as we all know, in some measure or the other, the imperative of countering terrorism is sort of is the big imperative of our time. And that's how it's depicted to us, and that's how we consume it as frightened citizens who are worried about the civilizational threat that these terrorists ostensibly pose. And, you know, this coercive apparatus of the state, including its surveillance apparatus in particular, has almost an unlimited mandate to act in the name of the security of the people. And explicit legislation, this is not even necessarily done as a state of exception. You know, it's done explicitly through legislation in parliaments. And in Pakistan's case, again, those of you who follow will know that there was a constitutional amendment passed early 2015 that facilitated the setting up of military courts. So essentially a parallel legal system was created to allow the military to prosecute religious militants. You know, the evidence suggests abuse of power even in cases where it's religious militants. You know, the evidence suggests abuse of power even in cases where it's religious militants that are being targeted. You know, the evidence suggests big abuse of power even in cases where it's religious militants that are being targeted. So one of the big abuse of power even in cases where it's religious militants that are being targeted. So one of the big abuse of power even in cases where it's religious militants that are being targeted. So one of the big hoo-ha events of recent times in Pakistan was this military operation in the Swat Valley in 2009, where, you know, the Pakistani Taliban and this guy Fazlullah had encroached up to, you know, let's say 200 kilometers of Islamabad, and a big hue and cry was raised, and then this big massive scorched earth operation was launched. And you know, subsequent, you know, a few months later, we were told everything is great, and the area has been cleared, and it's safe, and so on and so forth. But you know, again, in hushed tones, there's been there's been a lot of evidence of abuses of power. So, you know, some guy who happened to join the Taliban, his entire family has been victimized because he happened to join the Taliban, and these are things that don't come up in the mainstream, in the media or anywhere else. Similarly, in the so-called tribal areas in the north, every day you'll see an ISPR press release that's on the front page of a Pakistani newspaper. The ISPR is the military press service. And it's literally an ISPR press release because it'll say 25 terrorists killed in a military operation. It's not even like 25, the military claims 25 terrorists killed. They'll just say 25 terrorists are killed. And I had my students do a series of newspaper analyses tracing back to 2001, all of these newspaper reports. And they came up with an astonishing number of terrorists that have been killed, something like 14,000 since 2001. And you have to think, do these terrorists grow on trees? Are they like oranges? Because they just don't seem to end, right? The numbers just keep ballooning. But as I said, there's no critical comment about any of this. And there's another contemporary operation that's taking place in South Punjab. I don't know, again, those of you who follow. There was an attack, a rather gruesome attack, targeting Christians on Easter early this month in Lahore, where about 80 people were just brutally sort of killed by a blast. And that then precipitated a series of responses, again, largely from Rahil Sharif, with you know, his B-team, Nawaz, you know, chiming in, saying, well, this is all attributable to terrorists in South Punjab. I mean, we don't know who these terrorists are or where they came from, but apparently they exist. And over the last few days, there's been a series of operations taking place in the Rajanpur district. Again, it's on the front page of much of the newspaper, many of the newspapers. Who these people are, I mean, initially they were terrorists. The last few days, if you follow the newspaper, they've been called gang. I think it was the day before, it's difficult to say. And one of the, I think it was the day before, I don't even know when it was, two or three days ago, one of the, I think it was the day before, I don't even know when it was, two or three days ago, I think it was the day before, I don't even know when it was, two or three days ago, 25 policemen also apparently went missing in one of these operations, which then facilitated calls to say, okay, well, the entire operation should now be handed over to the army because the police and the civil administration is no longer capable of taking care of business. So, you know, there's all of these huge big question marks about these anti-terror operations in different parts of the country. And there's no answers because, in part because nobody asks these questions. And these questions are sort of all beneath the surface. And there's this apparent consensus, public opinion consensus that has been generated, which means that nobody needs to ask questions. And then there's other examples, just so you, you know, Ali mentioned Okada. Actually, over the last 2.5 days, Okada is back in the spotlight. Okada is this district in central Punjab where there's a 17,000-acre farm that has been run by the military since colonial times. And there's a population of more than 100, of about 50,000 families, tenant farmers, who've been tilling these lands essentially as landless sort of serfs. And in the year 2000, there was a big uprising in Okada against this arrangement. And a demand for these lands to be given over to the people who till them rather than stay in the hands of the military who, you know, could, which it, it, it's, it was you know, it's a matter of serious question why the military is controlling agricultural lands and for what purpose. I mean, it's said back in the day that these farms supplied cheese and milk to the forces fighting. This is in the British era. This farm was set up in 1913. So over the last 2.5 days, about 60 people have been arrested, all under anti-terror legislation in Okada. And their crime is that they're asking for land that they till, that they've been tilling for 100 years, to be handed over to them. There's an individual in Gilgit-Baltistan who drew attention, his name is Babajan, who drew attention to landslides in the Hunza Valley some 7 years ago. And he's been in jail for 4 years under anti-terrorist legislation. There's an individual in the Sheikhupura district of Punjab who was a trade unionist struggling for workers' rights. And he's been in jail for 5 years under anti-terrorist legislation. So the sheer breadth of how this legislation can be used betrays the fact that it was supposed to be dedicated to a very narrow purpose. And whether or not that's actually happening is now almost besides the point. The fact is that the state and the military in particular is empowered wherever it feels like to say, oh, well, here's a security threat, and let us employ whatever means necessary to deal with it. That having been said, my contention is that the most obvious, but Balochistan still are there and thereabouts. They're part of the discussion. But Balochistan is still are there and thereabouts. They're part of the discussion. But Balochistan is still the discussion thereabouts. They're part of the discussion. But Balochistan is generally not part of the discussion even. It's not even, it doesn't even occupy some space in the newspaper. And in Balochistan, there's been all sorts of things that I think we could talk about. So, for example, the very substantial differences between the religious right and this very secular Baloch insurgency has been very conveniently blurred. It's as if there's no difference between them, right? That, again, anyone who poses an ostensible threat to the state is just all the same. Even though, as I said, all of these legislations and all of these initiatives were initially supposed to target the Islamists almost exclusively. So there's a series of incidents, again, some of you may have followed, in Quetta from around 2012. There's an ethnic community in Quetta called the Hazaras, with historical roots in Balochistan. They're Shia. And they were subject to a series of rather gruesome attacks, some target killings, some bomb blasts, by a Sunni sectarian supremacist group called the Lashkar-e-Jhangvi. The reading between the lines, the Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, whenever it carried out attack, would leave a note. And the note would always have be signed off by someone with a Baloch surname. And, you know, upon investigation, it was established that most of the members of the Lashkar-e-Jhangvi were Brahvi speaking. Brahvi is the second biggest language spoken amongst the Baloch. People who've studied the Lashkar-e-Jhangvi will say that, well, it was also for a long time enjoyed state patronage. So there's evidence again there to suggest that, you know, there was a deliberate attempt to play off ethnic communities against one another, and also to create a mandate again for the state to go in and address these incidents of terrorism. There's also in recent times the Baloch insurgency has recruited heavily from amongst universities in Balochistan where Baloch students study, and in recent times there's been a significant attempt for the Tablighi Jamaat, which is a proselytizing entity, some of you will know, has gone into many universities and tried to wean Baloch youth away from nationalist politics and towards, you know, sort of more religious causes. In any case, The clampdown against Baloch insurgents has gathered considerable pace in the previous 12 to 18 months, unsurprisingly coinciding with intensified counter-terror initiatives ostensibly targeting religious militants, and also coinciding with the launch of CPEC. A report in the Herald, which is one of the few sort of independent publications that exist in Pakistan, this month, the April 2016 edition of the Herald, the FC, which is the paramilitary force that is very prominent in Balochistan, is reported to have killed 80. The police and the FC have also reportedly killed 40. The police and the FC have also reportedly killed 14. The police and the FC have also reportedly killed 14 alleged members of banned religious organizations in Quetta in the same period. So, 87 Baloch, secular Baloch insurgents versus 14 sort of members of religious groups. And the obverse side of these statistics, since early November last year, religious militants have killed more security personnel, 37, than Baloch militants who've killed 13. So you can see that there's like a very strange mismatch between the threat posed by these Baloch insurgents and the force being used against them. And this is sort of what brings me to my larger story about, about development and the concentration of power within the coercive apparatus of the state. So, I mean, as the erstwhile welfare state has receded into the dustbin of history, and any kind of state intervention in the economy and to regulate the market's failures to cater to society's most underprivileged, any kind has become taboo, has become almost like just ridiculed. The imperative, on the other hand, the imperative of capital accumulation, and particularly in countries like Pakistan, particularly foreign investment, has come to trump all else. It's interesting, if you have a drawing room conversation amongst Pakistan's chattering classes, and they really like their drawing room conversations, their big thing about terrorism and the imperative of peace is usually, well, why do we need to get rid of terrorism? Why do we need peace? Well, because otherwise there'll be no foreign investment. And our country can't progress if there's no foreign investment. So even peace is sort of functional to this. So this foreign investment is like this mythical be-all, end-all solution to all of the country's problems, right? Why do we, those, again, many of you know, Pakistan has big problems with power generation, with electricity. So why do we need electricity? Not because, last summer, not because 500 people died in Karachi, but because if there's no electricity, then foreign investors won't show up. And how can our country progress if there's no foreign? I mean, it's another matter whether investment is necessary or not. I'm just giving you a sense of the mythical, the proportions to which this idea has gone. And it's thus that China's injection of $50 billion is just, like I said, considered a game changer. There's this perception that nobody else is willing to come into Pakistan and pump money, and China's doing it. So, it's almost heretical to question the fundamental assumptions that prevail about this development that's going to take place. Like, if you question it, you're off the deep end. You're crazy almost. So you can't question development, you can't question security, and therefore any other aspect of this dominant narrative. It all comes as a package. So it's, for instance, the military has a blank check to our force, and the military has a blank check to ask, and the military has a blank check to ask the federal, and the military has a blank check to ask the federal or whatever, and the military has a blank check to ask the federal government for whatever, and the military has a blank check to ask the federal government for whatever, and the military has a blank check to ask the federal government for whatever funds it needs to make sure this force is very quickly assembled. And of course, this is not just because the military decided to do it, it's because China has asked for this security to protect the development that is going to be brought in by CPEC. Who is this force answerable to? Is the protection of Chinese money and personnel more important than the lives of and property of the local Baloch population, who, by the way, may or may not be welcoming of the Chinese development miracle, mind you, that is a possibility. Gwadar is a classic example. Gwadar is this tiny little fishing village, which is now being depicted as like, you know, the new Dubai, and it's going to become this big sort of parallel Dubai, and, you know, bring Pakistan all sorts of riches. Over the last 15 years, property prices in Gwadar have skyrocketed because of speculation. Local sort of property owners have been bought out. And one of the big things that the Baloch nationalists have been saying for a long time, one of their fears, however well-founded those fears may be, is the fact that there's going to be demographic shifts associated with, you know, the coming of in of so much money and personnel from other countries and so on into places like Gwadar. I mean, basically the argument is that, look, development may be taking place, but development is taking place not necessarily to benefit local people, but to sort of channel whatever resources Balochistan has away from Balochistan. There's a lot of evidence that mineral mining, again, evidence that has not necessarily come to the surface. I mean, there's a couple of projects that are well known copper mines in an area called Sandak. There's a number of other big projects. There's a lot of minerals under Balochistan's fairly substantial mountain ranges. How those are being meted out, how those contracts are being to the extent to which there's any due process involved in that, all of these are very big, real questions. And, you know, the Baloch, even mainstream Baloch politicians raise these questions to their own risk, frankly, let alone insurgents. Of course, insurgents have a different take on this entirely. Their argument is that the Pakistani state and the Punjab-dominated Pakistani state has little claim or moral, ethical claim to these resources, which at least in part belong to the Baloch people. And mind you, of course, I think it doesn't, it bears bearing in mind that this is the only country in the world where ethnic majority is seceded from a minority population. Visions over indigenous. Look, of course, there's nothing particularly new about states bulldozing developmental visions over indigenous people. In the name of bulldozing developmental visions over indigenous people, in the name of the greater developmental visions over indigenous people, in the name of the greater national interest, developmental visions over indigenous people, in the name of the greater national interest, mental visions over indigenous people, in the name of the greater national interest. I mean, this was visions over indigenous people. In the name of the greater national interest. I mean, this was the over indigenous people. In the name of the greater national interest. I mean, this was the norm even during the heyday of the developmental state between the 50s and the 70s, right? You know, Nehru's dams as being modern temples, you know, all of the big sort of third worldists of the 50s and 60s were similarly sort of in some ways blind to these questions. But I think there are significant differences between those examples of the past and the neoliberal developmental initiatives of the contemporary era. Particularly notable, and that's what I've tried to point out to you, in today's world is the manner in which there is a symbiotic relationship between an expanded coercive apparatus of the state and the fact of capital's hypermobile and transnational character. And in some ways, that's all the state is left to do. Because the state's not allowed to intervene in the marketplace and not allowed to sort of allocate resources outside of the logic of the market, God forbid. So the state's only role is to smooth out resistance to, you know, foreign capital. And that is what development is. That is the sum total of how development is conceived. Money comes in from the outside, it is welcomed, and anybody that doesn't welcome it is told, is given a shut-up call by the state. If you accept it gracefully, then, you know, you may get the root passing through your end of the woods. And if you don't accept it and you are more militant in your resistance, you get, you know, a 13,000 strong military force set up to make sure that you don't cause any trouble. Now, I mean, that's obviously a very sort of dumbed down way of thinking about it. But in some ways, what's happening in Balochistan is sort of a very dumbed down approach. And the reason why that sort of approach can fly is precisely because it doesn't occupy any space within the mainstream. There's no substantial questions that are even raised about these sorts of issues. And like I said, where I started, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, what was happening in Balochistan in terms of a historical perspective was part of the debate. It's not a mistake that the question of missing persons, which is a real question, you can't disappear hundreds of young people over a period of a decade and that not be a real question in the modern world, in today's world. But that question itself has disappeared from the mainstream. And so the only question remaining in Balochistan is how do we make sure that Chinese investment is protected from any kind of popular disaffection? This is not, mind you, to suggest that those who are, whether they be even, like I said, you know, intellectuals who operate in Punjab, where, let's say, generally speaking, historically, there's been much less resistance to dominant narratives. Any kind of question is considered heretical. And that's what I want to point out to you. And I think that is representative of our time. And it is, as Sana pointed out in her introduction, that there is an entire shrinking of space in this so-called post-ideological era in which we live. Right? There is no ideology. There is no, as Maggie Thatcher says, there is no society. There are only individuals. And we are just supposed to clap our hands and say, well, development is good. We want security. And the state is empowered to do whatever it needs to do to make both of those things happen. I think I'll leave it there.